Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's gonna hate you, and she's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
That's almost 52 years so far. The world has become a worse and worse place. Every year we have polluted more water than the year before. Every year there's been less clean air than there was the year before that. Every year there are fewer species on the planet than the year before that. We're driving 200 species a day to extinction. We're about to see that turn around. The loving planet is about to make a comeback. And that's really, really good news.
That's last and she's coming out swinging. She bats last and she's just about taking all that she can take. And it's payback time.
Hi everyone, welcome to Nature Bats Last radio show. I'm Pauline Schneider in New York, and this is the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. Our theme song is provided as a gift by Afrizen, and you can find more of his work on SoundCloud. Today I'm talking with Cliff Weathers, who comes to Riverkeeper after 30 years as a writer, editor, and multimedia producer. He served as a deputy editor of Consumer Reports for 10 years, focusing on automotive reliability, green technologies, and product safety. As Alternate's senior editor, Cliff documented how communities are impacted by extreme forms of fossil fuel extraction and crude oil transportation. His articles on green consumerism, alternative energy, and sustainability have appeared in several publications, including Salon and Raw Story. Cliff graduated from Oakland University in suburban Detroit, where he was a journalism major. A Michigan native, Cliff came to New York in 1995 and resides in South Nyack. Cliff, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Pauline. Nice to be here.
It's really great. It was a beautiful night. It was raining all day. We had really amazing weather today. It was like warnings of bad weather and dangerous weather, and we had some scattered rain.
Sunsets are nice, aren't they?
Stunning. We took a couple of beautiful photos out here. It looks great. It's just, well, the sun is gone now, but we're sitting at the Bridgeview Tavern in Tarrytown, New York, looking over the Hudson River at the Tappan Zee Bridge, which is in the process of being rebuilt, remade, renewed, whatever you want to call it. And you can see all of the barges out there with their all the equipment, getting ready to make this amazing new bridge. Cliff, I have so many wonderful questions for you about wonderful Riverkeeper.
Okay.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you came to the Riverkeeper and the history of the Riverkeeper?
Personally, for me, I've been a journalist for 30 years. I spent the last 5 or 6 years blogging about the environment. Ended up working for Alternate and being a writer, where I was in charge of all the environmental content. A lot of my concerns were about fracking, about Indian Point. I was writing a lot of the same things that they were doing, so I'm glad that they brought me on the team. It's a fantastic organization. They do great work.
So, Cliff, tell me a little bit about the River Keeper and what was the attraction to joining them? You've been with Alternet. You've been with Consumer Reports.
Well, first of all, River Keeper started in 1966 as a Hudson River Fishermen's Association. Basically, a bunch of concerned fishermen that were wondering why the fish were dying up in their areas. Here, started by Bob Boyle, who is a writer like me for Sports Illustrated and many other publications. So it sort of evolved where they started bringing in boats, patrol boats, finding out where the pollution was coming from. And that's basically the history of the organization. And for me, and my reason for joining is that that's sort of what I want to do. As a journalist, I always strive to be not only a reporter, but somebody that actually was trying to create something, trying to make action happen, trying to make people react to something. Coming to Riverkeeper basically did some same thing that I wanted to do, which was, take care of things, take care of the river, and that's our major client. The river is our only thing. I live nearby the river. When I came to move to New York 20-some years ago, I fell in love with the Hudson River, and it's my big love affair now, and now I'm glad to be there.
Now, you spent the day on the river today. You said you were on the boat today?
Yeah, I was on the boat. I was on the boat. We're not supposed to say this, but I snuck on the boat. I was on the boat. I was also on the boat over the weekend, and during the 4th of July weekend, I was over in the Gowanus Canal and the Newtown Creek, which are the two most polluted waterways in New York City. The Gowanus Canal is one of the most polluted waterways, if not the most polluted waterway in the United States. We were in a little tiny tin boat, so we were right next to the water. I mean, when I say 2 inches from the water, it was all the coal ash is coming up and bubbling, and there's methane gas coming out of there. And you see the creosote comes out there, and it smells terrible. And there's sewage. They have the combined sewer overflows where the sewage from your household sewage is combined with the sewage from the storm drains, and they come out there. It was a dry day that day, so it didn't smell so bad. But it's basically a huge sewer. It's a Superfund site that's going to, the EPA is going to start restoring sometime soon. But it was really amazing. I'm not advising anyone to take a sail on there, but you don't know how bad it is, and you don't know what kind of filth that we've actually created until you've been there. So
we're gonna pause a moment while this helicopter goes over. Oh, that's great that went away now. So that's amazing that you can actually watch that stuff bubbling up.
Mm-hmm.
What's the prospect for communities like that have to deal with that sort of thing?
Well, as far as the Gowanus Canal is concerned, there's a lot of apartments. It's become a very gentrified area. People want that area to be nice. They want that canal to be nice. We don't know. I mean, there's no way of telling if the Gowanus can ever be restored. I mean, there's so many different problems. I mean, the problems come from many, many different angles. And I'm really hoping that one day that they'll figure it out. But, there's got to be a lot of thought put into it, and a lot of things have to change. The big thing that's sort of worrisome when you see them are these things called the combined sewer overflows, which are CSOs, otherwise known, is basically when there's too much rain, the rainwater combines with what comes out of our bathrooms, and it gets into a system that pushes out into the Gowanus or pushes out into different areas around New York. The Gowanus gets a lot of it in Brooklyn. And you see these things, these pipes everywhere, and they're the most amazingly odd things when you see them, because they could be brick pipes, they could be these brick inlays, they could be these concrete pipes, and they're everywhere. And after a huge rain, the crap, it's crap, it's excrement coming in there, and it's combining with coal ash, all these different pollutants, all these things that people have dumped in there for many generations. This has been a sewer before you and I were around, before our parents were around. How are we going to resurrect that? I don't know if that's going to happen, but we got to try,
So. That's interesting. When we had Sandy and Katrina, not mm-hmm. Katrina, but, our
Irene.
Irene, thank you. In Manhattan,
right.
It destroyed many of the copper telephone lines.
Mm-hmm.
And that was that's a huge problem even to this day. They're still trying to figure that out. And they really haven't figured that out yet. Now I know the river. That's not the River Keeper's focus. You know, how do we fix copper phone lines? Their focus is the Hudson River and the health of the river, and not the beauty of the river. But you know, if something's beautiful, usually it's healthy. So that, but that doesn't always follow. It's come back a lot in the years. I've only lived in New York now for the past 28 years. And I've seen a change myself. I've seen it getting better in many ways and worse in other ways. But I have seen the River Keeper be a significant partner in improving the river and making people aware of the problems, helping to educate the community.
Right.
And what are some of the current focuses of the River Keeper? What's it focusing on right now?
Well, to describe the river, it's there's an old Buddhist parable about the three men and the elephant, and three blind men and the elephant, where they all see something very different. It depends on where you are. If you're up in Albany or you're to Poughkeepsie, the biggest concern probably for you is PCBs, which were dumped by General Electric for generations, which General Electric has been dredging them and trying to clear them up. And the idea that they're not going to be really done when they finish up this last season that they're required by this, their obligations, their federal obligations. There's so much done there. So if you're up there, that's your concern with the river. When you get into the mid-river, there's just basically pollution from water treatment facilities that haven't been maintained correctly, that they haven't kept up with the population. So you have all these tributaries like the Wallkill River, the Esposas Creek, all these different places that are really of, you know, the tributaries themselves, their health is endangered, and so is the river in those areas. As you get down south here, you got the Tappan Zee Bridge and this construction and what its impact is on the environment and the fish in the area. You got very many, and as you get down the river, it's a different story. When you get into in Manhattan, like I said, the combined sewer overflows. You've got all sorts of different pollution problems just by having such a large population. In the meantime, you do have things that are going right. You do have areas that are swimmable. You have places like Croton Point Park. You have places up the river where people could actually get in there. So, not so much when you get past New Jersey, but when you're north here, when you can actually swim. And it's a safe place. You find a little eddy, and people could swim there. They have public beaches. People don't realize that they're very safe, very beautiful, pristine beaches here that you can have. Why can't we have that for everyone? I mean, when you talk about swimming, we're not just talking about people swimming, you know, we're talking about paddleboarders and kayakers and stuff like that. I think we are, as humans, we're drawn to the water. I mean, this is what we are. We evolved from apes that became water-based. That's why we're like very hairless and we take to the water. This is what's really important to us. We have to really respect this river and take care of it, because we're drawn to this. I'm drawn to this. I'm drawn to the water. I think that this is what we're not quite, but as far as primates, we're the most aquatic ones there are. This is our duty. This is why we're here. We're not in the jungle. We're on the river. We're near the oceans. We're near waterways like the Hudson, the Colorado River, the Mississippi River. We have to respect these waterways. I think that's very important. See the mountains around it, and you see how it touches the land. And basically, when you look at the water, all you're seeing is like this mirror. You're seeing the surface reflection. You're not really seeing the river. You're seeing just this top of it, this glaze. When you get under there, there's a whole jungle. There's a whole different world. And I think people have to realize that. I mean, we have people that live near me. They live by the river. And if they were to cut down all the trees in a park by their house, in a state park by their house, they would be very upset by that. It would be, well, why would you do that? We've been doing this to the river for a long time. We've been doing this to the environment right next to us. Just because you can't see it doesn't mean it's not there and it doesn't affect you and beautify your life. Trees are a beautiful thing. I would like us not to deforest our areas at all and not develop a lot of areas that are being developed personally. However, you have to give that same consideration to what you can't see. You have to look beyond what is beyond the looking glass of the surface of the river, I think.
And you know, there's that great saying, the comeback kid. Mm-hmm. And the river has some comeback fish.
Yes.
And some really good comeback fish stories. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, there's certain ones. I mean, the sturgeon have been coming back. They were nearly extinct. You have the short nose, and you have the Atlantic sturgeon here. There have been more numbers in recent years. We're happy about that. You're seeing some more of some smaller foraging fish coming back. You're seeing more herring. There's been a lot of good stories. There have been some worrisome stories, though, and I think we're going to touch on this anyway. We've had several fish kills and on the river this year, and people are very worried about that. And a lot of people want to blame the Tappasee Bridge. They want to blame Indian Point. We don't know what it is. There's actually happening in other places. It's happening in the Quinnipiac River. It's happening in the Connecticut River. It's happening on Long Island Sound, Peconic River. So it's happening all over the place. And this is not to say that it's the same cause for all of it, but there's been an unusual amount of activity. And these fish kills are basically these small fish, what we call mossmucker or Manhattan fish. They're very small herring-like fish that forage. It could be many reasons for them to be why they're dying off. It could be that there's a lot of them. Actually, it could be that there's
a lot of reasons.
Well, no, it could be that there's a lot of fish too.
Oh.
You could be seeing big. One of the big reasons why you have fish kills often is low oxygenated water, and that can be because of too much algae that takes the oxygen out of the water. It could also be because there's a lot of fish. They swim in very tight formations, and if they get chased in the shallow waters by predators like bluefish, they breathe really fast with their gills. You know, some may die there. It could be diseases like worrying disease. It could be toxins in the river. It could be thermal stresses where the water changes temperatures really quickly. Now, this has been sent to the aquatic lab at Cornell University weeks ago. This started in the 1st of June. We don't know why this is happening yet. It's very worrisome, but I'm not quite convinced that it's anything tied to anything that is specific to the Hudson River. I think this might be more of a regional event. And like I said, it could also be a disease. But we don't know this. And we have to be patient, not point any fingers right now. I mean, it's really easy to say, oh, this is Indian Point, or this is the Tappasee Bridge. We don't know this. And the big thing, it could be something that's less significant than we think. But with saying all these terrible things about these fish kills, there have been more fish. The fishermen are saying that they're seeing more successes. They're seeing a lot more herring in the water. They're much more happy with what they're seeing. And I think that science, when the numbers come out, that we'll find that there's a little bit of a comeback with fish, and hopefully it'll be successful in the long term. I have one thing to add to that, though. A lot of fish are still not edible because of the amount of PCBs in the water. You can have striped bass because they're not native to the area. They just come into the river to eat smaller foraging fish, so they have very little of the PCBs in there. You can't eat things like catfish or eel, or really you can't eat carp, and you can eat very few blue crabs. It would be nice to have a day where the river is healthy enough where there's much less PCBs in the river, where you could eat all these fish without worrying about disease, without worrying about hurting yourself. So that's what I like to see.
Oh, I have a great story about eating crab from the Hudson River. Several years ago, I was at a friend's house, and we were munching away on the crab, and we're like, oh my God, this is so good. Where did you get this? And the fellow who brought it to my friend's party, he said, over up in Croton, I sat on the wall there and just fished the crab. And by the way, that's just a few minutes from Indian Point, from the radio, one of the most radioactive leaking nuclear power plants in the country.
Right.
you can imagine how very quickly we stopped eating the crab that night.
I don't think a couple of crabs would have hurt you, but I would probably stop eating them myself.
Well, I mean, we were able to stop eating, but I'm sure he still kept fishing, and I don't really know how that fella's doing these days or if he's still around.
Well, I've had blue crabs from Haverstraw Bay, and I enjoy them. But you know, you can have very, very few. The DEC has a really good guideline for women of childbearing age. You have to be very careful. Children have to be careful as well. So, I mean, men, you know, just give the guys whatever you want. But no, not quite. But
let's not worry about their sperm.
Precisely. Well, you know, we gotta if anyone ever wonders what you can eat and out of the Hudson River, please go to the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation site. They'll tell you what you can and can't eat. So,
I have a beef with the DEC, and I don't know if I'm going to bring it up right now, but I really wouldn't trust very much of what they have to say, based on my experience with them. And back in '93, with the toxic waste incinerator they wanted to install right on the Hudson River in a community. And we fought it tooth and nail, and we actually ended up having Mario Cuomo's wife help us. And they decided they weren't going to incinerate PCBs from a Con Edison pool of gunk that had been sitting on the train property for decades, leaking into the Hudson River. They were going to move it to somebody else's backyard. But so I have my reservations with the DEC. So, but you know, feel free to check them out and see what they have to say.
A lot of good people work there.
I'm sure.
That's all I'm going to say. That's my only comment on that. Thank you.
I'm sure. Listen, the people don't make up the organization. I know people say that, oh, the people is what make the organization. It's the ones at the top who make the organization what it is, unfortunately. And the rest of us have to go along with what they decide. And that's what we found as a community, that our concerns were not heeded. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm sure individuals within the organization were honest and good people. But the ones at the top, very, very questionable. In my opinion. So, Cliff, I wanted to ask you, there was a study that came out by Alex Gunderson and Jonathan Stillman, who are biologists at the Romberg Tiburon Center for Environmental Studies at the San Francisco State University. And this study showed that ectotherms had very little ability to adapt to rising temperatures, and that they showed an increased death rate to overheating. They weren't able to adapt to even just small changes. You know, usually right. They can go into shade or they can go to water. But even fish are ectotherms, and they really don't have anywhere else to go other than the water that they're in. And I wonder if, you know, we've got this, you know, we are in global warming situation right now.
Sure.
And I wonder if maybe that could have something to do. I know that you said that there's very little information about what's actually causing, but perhaps that might have something to do with it.
Well, I'm not a marine biologist. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a marine biologist. I do have to say that, you know, the changing temperatures of the ocean, the acidification of the ocean, all these things are really affecting the quality of marine life and the survivability. The Hudson River is actually sort of fortunate because the sedimentary rock below it actually has a very high pH, so you don't seem to have the ocean acidification problems. You do have, and as we are in a northern climate, I'm not quite sure how much the actual water temperatures have changed as compared to ocean temperatures. I don't know this. I do know that I do have my own concerns about the ocean. My concerns about the ocean are, I'm concerned about the changes in temperature affecting fish. I'm more concerned about acidification. I mean, acidification is like the evil twin of global warming that nobody ever talks about. Basically, what's happening is the carbon that men create gets in the water, and it creates carbonic acid, and the oceans become very acidic. This changes coral from being this beautiful, you know, like with all these different tendrils and fingers sticking out, where little tiny fish and zooplankton and protoplankton can sort of hide and thrive, to these things that are these white mushrooms that don't hide or protect fish, and they don't create a habitat for them. This is the big worry about the ocean. I mean, this has very little to do with the river. When you have oysters that, you know, the oysters, during when you have situations of ocean acidification, they don't create the shells, the strong shells that they would normally create. These are huge problems. I really do have a lot of concerns personally about this. I talked to a colleague today about acidification in the Hudson River. There's still concerns about it, don't get me wrong, but I think that there's somewhat protection. Basically, the sedimentary rock is the same thing as like what you have in Tums or any sort of antacid. It basically keeps the pH level up. Right. So we have that. So we have a couple things going there. But there's when you talk about the temperatures affecting the animals, I'm more concerned about the acidification of the oceans, which is, like I said, the evil twin of global warming.
Well, the phytoplankton,
right,
they provide, I forget, it's like 50% of our oxygen.
Yeah.
And a significant percentage of phytoplankton have,
sure,
died off because of ocean acidification.
Yeah.
I mean, that's in alone concern for us.
Yeah.
But, I mean, is there phytoplankton? I'm not a biologist myself, but maybe you know this. Is there phytoplankton in freshwater river?
I do not know the composition of fresh river water. This is a salinated river, however.
Yes.
We're salinated up to like Croton Point right now. I mean, the salt line ends at different areas, but it's south of Poughkeepsie. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's gone north of Poughkeepsie. Actually, Poughkeepsie, both the town and the city, draw their water from the river because it's not salinated, mm-hmm, up there. So, and sometimes it does actually push up there, depending on like what, you know, the tides are, whatever kind of events there may be, temperatures, whatever. But basically, this is brackish to salty as salty as an ocean can be. So this is, you look at this as an estuary that has, that is, it can support whales. Sharks could be here. I've seen a manatee in this river. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. It's a beautiful, beautiful, pristine river that we should be protecting. And I don't know, I'm just sort of getting all teary-eyed about it right now. So
why do we let jet skis on it?
I don't know. I'll have to say, you know, in defense of people that have things like jet skis and things like that, somehow at least they're enjoying it. And maybe if they engage in the river in some way, if they're not the greatest thing for the health of, I mean, they're loud. They make a lot of smoke. Precisely. However, you know, I'm all for, if somebody's engaging with the river in some way like that, maybe when they get a little bit too old for those jet skis, they might pull out a fishing pole, or they might decide to paddleboard or kayak instead and just sort of enjoy the river in the way that it should be enjoyed. I just see it. If it's a gateway drug and it's a bad thing at first, I'm hoping that they will sort of convert into the more mellow ways and possibly become someone that becomes a little bit of a, you know, a caretaker for the river. And I think what you see is a lot of people that are that are into marine recreation, that like paddleboarding, kayaking, fishing, and stuff. These are the people that work with us the most. These are the people that come to Riverkeeper and say, we want to help you clean up. We have a sweep in May where we just clean up all these different beaches around the river and areas on the tributaries as well, put new plantings in there, new grasses, new trees, whatnot. The people that do this are the kayakers, or the people that are on dragon boat teams, or the people that fish and swim. And it's because this is their river, and somehow, like me, they're drawn to it, and they have to protect it. And I think that if somebody has something like a jet ski, well, you know, something that might be their toy, they might not quite understand any sort of harm that they're doing. But, you know, there's other things that create harm to the river. And I think hopefully someday they'll change, and they'll get themselves a sit-on-top kayak or something like that and just mellow out.
Well, that would be nice if we lived that long. You know, there's this whole NTHC theory.
Yeah, I'm not getting into that.
Near-term human extinction. Well, anyway, yes. But, you know, I was, I participated as an observer last year. Was it last year? on the Hudson River when they had the wampum kayak, where the Native Americans carried this agreement of peace, and they rode their horses and they kayaked down the Hudson River,
right,
all the way from the very top of the Hudson River down to Manhattan. And it was the most amazing thing to watch. Did you get to see any of that?
No, I must have been out of town at the time. Unfortunately,
it was beautiful. It was really incredible. And I'll share some pictures,
okay,
and videos that I shot and took at the time, because it was really quite beautiful. I mean, because it's really part of the history of the Hudson River, that the Native American piece, mm-hmm, that we don't usually think about. They were amazing. These men rode in on their horses in full regalia. Mm-hmm. And it was so moving and heartbreaking, because they had made this peace agreement 400 years ago that has not been honored in 400 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they were renewing it during that time. So it was really beautiful to watch all of the kayakers coming down the river, including one of my dear friends, Cameron Kelly, a very, very visible activist and an amazing person. She's just incredible. So she was part of this whole thing. And I was very proud to be a witness, even though I didn't kayak. I think I would have died. Cliff, one of the big things that the Riverkeeper is focused on is helping, aiding and abetting the closing of Indian Point, and being, really, promoting that, progressive towards making that happen. And there's some question about, what are you guys doing also about the Spectra pipeline, which is, going in right next to Indian Point. And a lot of people are asking about that.
Well, there's been some concerns with people wondering if we're doing enough for this. I mean, there's a lot of things we can be doing. We're a small organization. We have a few lawyers. We have my small communications team. We have a couple of people that are administrators. The one thing we have to worry about right now is closing Indian Point, first of all. Take care of that. Get the plant offline. The relicensing is where we're focused. So it's not there. It does not exist. The pipeline is, as far as we're concerned, it's a bad idea. As far as we can see, it's still not there. It's still not a reality right now there. We have to deal with the realities of the situation, which is Indian Point. We can stop this. We can close this plant. We can make a lot of these things a non-issue. We can fight this as a separate issue. A lot of times people want this to be, they want to put these two things and create this amalgam issue. That doesn't, like I said, we're in a large way, we're, we're an advocacy organization, but we're also a legal organization. And we have to make sure that that when we argue points about things, that we have got all of our I's dotted and our T's crossed, that we're doing this right, that we're not just pounding our hands on the table. So this is kind of a very important thing. I get the feedback from people more than anyone else, and I'm worried about what people think. I mean, I really do. I am concerned about what they think about this, but trust me, this is not some issue that we're forgetting about, and we haven't dropped the ball on this. We want to take care of what is here and present, and is the present danger to us, mm-hmm, which is Indian Point. This is a clear and present danger. It is the biggest danger. If you live in the Hudson Valley, if you live, 20 million people live within a 50-mile radius of this, it could be a very small event that could make us, there's no evacuation plan, it can make us all, drive us all away. It could create irreparable harm to this whole country, to the world. I mean, this is New York City we're talking about. This is
the navel of the planet.
The navel of the planet? Well, they have different. Some people would use a different body part to describe it. I would, I would say. But where do you put 20 million refugees? What happens to this country when you have this? And you have, if something like this was to happen, we have to create. We have to right now take care of this danger, this which is right there. This is what, when you talk about Spectra, Algonquin, all the Pilgrim Pipeline questions, you have to look at these things as these are things that are present in some areas and potentially harmful in the future. We have to look at the things that right now can, that tomorrow can harm us, could change our way of life, could change everything about this world. I mean, so like I said, we're a small organization still. We're focusing on what we could do, where we think we could be the best help.
Well, some people say that Indian Point closing is already a done deal. I mean, it's operating without a license, so they feel like that's going to happen anyway.
There's a great movie that just came out called Indian Point. If you see this, the director of the movie, Ivy Mirapol, did a great job of making sure that she presented all sides of the story, even the engineers and the people that were the spokespeople for Indian Point, the managers of it, including colleagues of mine from Riverkeeper, and people from different organizations that were against it. What you get from seeing this film is that the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, is not willing. They seem to be somewhat complicit in keeping it open. If you look at it the way that we see it, I don't think that this is something that we can say that this is a done deal. This is a nuclear power plant that is, the infrastructure is 40 years old. That's old. Would you trust the reliability of a 40-year-old car or a 40-year-old toaster or a 40-year-old dishwasher? You wouldn't do that. You would think, God, these things could break down, and they could make my kitchen floor wet. I could be stuck in traffic. This is not a car. This is not a toaster. This is not a dishwasher. This is a nuclear power plant. If this breaks down, if this has a meltdown, this is not a small event. It's a huge, huge thing. So I don't trust that the NRC is going to do the right thing. I think that we have to look at the many different options we have as citizens of this state, as shareholders in this of this river, and see what other options we have to get it closed.
I think that makes absolute sense. About a year and a half ago, I was in New York City for I think it was Clearwater that held this. It was Fukushima Lessons Learned at the 92nd Street Y. It was amazing. And they had the former prime minister of Japan, and they were speaking about Fukushima. And they showed a little video clip of Indian Point. They had the boat out next to Indian Point that went up to it, very close to the release tunnel where the hot water is released from. Mm-hmm. And nobody did anything. They sat there for 4 hours and nothing happened. And finally, somebody came out to them and said, "What are you guys doing here?" And it was an example of how fragile it is.
Right.
And fast forward just a few weeks ago, a Mylar balloon flew into, was the backup energy, what was
yeah,
it, the,
it
the
flew,
power?
It flew into a line, into an electrical line, and caused a power outage.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, I'm sure that this wasn't what's on the balloon, but there is a Mylar balloon, you can look it up if you don't believe me, that has Homer Simpson on it, where he says "do," and it's a Mylar balloon like that. So it's sort of fitting if that was what it actually was. But I mean, and I never would want anything bad. I'm praying that nothing ever happens bad at Indian Point. But it just shows you how, I mean, how fragile it is. And I mean, all power plants can have transformer explosions. All of them can have these mishaps like this. However, two things. Indian Point has had three transformer mishaps, accidents, in 8 years. That's a lot. That's
they just had two in the last
2 months. They had a fire.
Well, the second one wasn't actually a transformer accident, but they've had three major transformer accidents in the last 8 years. That's a lot.
Yeah.
We don't know why, but that's a lot. Also, if it was a coal-fired plant and they had three, the only problem might be that there might be a fire at a coal plant, which actually burns coal. This is not something that can be contained in a small area. This is something that, if something goes wrong, spreads over 50, 60, 75 mile area. This is a very big concern. When you say, oh, transformer accidents happen at any plant, these transformer accidents are contained. The transformers are not in the area where, you know, the fuel is, you know, where the active fuel is. They're not under the dome. They're in a separate area. However, if they can't contain these fires, if these fires get out of hand, what happens then? The funny thing about the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is that the amount of insulation that they have, there was a 3-hour requirement for fire insulation on the cables and the electrical cables for this plant on the safety systems. Mm-hmm. What happened was when they discovered that Indian Points did not last that long, lasted much less, they took it down to 26 minutes. So Indian Points cables might not be as good as the electrical cables that come into your house. They're likely not. So you have to consider that. You've got a nuclear power plant that just gets exemption after exemption just because they want to keep this thing open. This is a really big concern.
Wow. So 20 million people don't really matter that much. It's the handful of people who have stock in Entergy.
Well, I don't know anything about the people from Entergy. I'm sure that they believe what they believe. I'm sure that they believe that it's safe. I know differently. I believe differently. Our organization believes differently. I hope they see the light. I hope they see that, you know, this is something that we all share in. I mean, the one man that was in the Indian Point movie, who's one of the chief engineers there, he was very confident that this is, that they've got everything together, that they've got all their stuff together. But there's a lot of stuff that we're finding. I mean, even the most recent transformer fire, they found that it was because it was an insulation failure. It was not electrical insulation. It's the insulation on the transformer failed. They're starting to notice that transformer failed because of a problem with that transformer, not because it was old, because it wasn't an old transformer. It's a huge problem when you cannot keep your systems operating, and they admit to these things, but they don't want to admit to the how important and how critical they are. And that's what I think that it's got to change. Somehow we have to change everyone's opinion about how dangerous Indian Point is. I understand a lot of people don't think that Indian Point is much of a concern. A lot of them are sort of agnostic about it. The best we could do is keep telling them how harmful this could be to them. So,
well, you know, at the Fukushima Lessons Learned forum that I participated, I didn't participate in it, but I was at, Gregory Jasko, the former, Nuclear Regulatory Commissioner for the United States, said Indian Point is in worse condition than Fukushima was.
Oh, definitely.
Worse condition. So we have a nuclear power plant that is next to one of the largest populations on the planet, the center of the economic heart of the world. At least we like to think so. And we have a nuclear power plant that is in a worse condition than Fukushima. And they're built the same way. It's the same construction. And I am going to cut to right now. I'm going to show you. I'm going to play the short little clip. When I asked my question at this forum, how long it takes to decommission a power plant. Because closing a power plant, we can close it tomorrow, which we're hoping that Indian Point will be closed, you know, tomorrow or sometime this year. That's very possible. But decommissioning it is another story, because decommissioning it is actually dealing with all the radioactive waste that's sitting there. Just because you close a power plant, it doesn't mean you get rid of the danger. It's still there. So run Spectra pipeline next to it, even if it's closed, you still have, you know, a really dangerous situation. So here's that clip. Here's what they had to say. All right, so tell me what you think about that little comment.
I think that that's what about what.
What Jasko
said, yeah. Oh, I think I really think that it's, you know, he was in charge of the NRC. He was the suit. He was the guy with the tie on. He was the guy that was trying to say everything is going to be all right. There's nothing to see here, folks. He changed his tune when he started seeing how dangerous this was, and then he started to tell the truth. He became a truth teller after he was ousted. When you say something like that. When you start telling people that just because you close the plant down and it's not making power, you've got to find ways to get rid of the nuclear waste. You have to find ways to get, you know, to take this down. I don't even know what that time frame would be. I mean, I've heard estimates much longer than what he said. I think that it is going to be a danger to us for that period of time. The spent fuel is not underneath those big domes that you see there. It is in a building that is no different. It's cinder block. It's no different than what you would see like a Home Depot would be or something like that. That is not a protected area. That is where the big problems are. You've got this nuclear waste, which is already the water, the pools that it is in, are already leaking. It's leaking. There's a plume, and it gets into the groundwater, and it gets in the Hudson River. You have tritium and strontium-90 getting into the river. This is something that's going to go on for a while. You know, they can take the waste out, they can contain it, they can do a lot of things. But it's just because you close it, it's not something that we could all just get up and cheer about. There's a long, long process that will be generations from now. And he was being very honest with everyone. And I think that's, you know, one of the things that people have to, like, come to grips with is that when you fight this battle, if we close it, the battle's not even anywhere near over. It's generations. It'll be a generational battle.
And we have near-term human extinction.
What's that?
And we have near-term human extinction to deal with.
I can't comment on that.
I know, you're not a biologist.
No.
Are you familiar with Tim Garrett's... he's the professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Utah, and he has called civilization a heat engine. It is the cause of any heat that we have, in other words, the greenhouse gases. And the only way to actually stop that is to end civilization. Are you familiar with any of that?
I'm familiar with it, but of course, everything I talk about as a representative for Riverkeeper is about the river.
Well,
so you couldn't catch me with that one.
No, but I'm thinking, you know, if we have heat
right.
as a cause for fish kills, if we have heat as a cause for rising temperatures, you know, all around us, I wonder what it is that we as citizens can do and how we can participate in reducing any kind of greenhouse gases that we create. You know, a lot of people think that wind turbines and solar panels and all that stuff is going to help. But, you know, as we scratch the surface of that, sort of like going beneath the surface of the Hudson River, you look beneath that, there's a forest. And that forest shows that all of those so-called... Exactly. So-called renewables and sustainable energy comes at a price.
Oh, yeah.
And that price is mining for rare earth minerals mm-hmm. and the destruction of other people's environments. And then all that stuff has to be shipped here mm-hmm. to be constructed. And that creates CO2 in addition to all of the destruction that it has caused in mining of it. So what do you think, I mean, and what does the Riverkeeper propose? What does it tell people to do in light of that?
Basically, as far as alternative energies are concerned, when I say that our focus is and our only client is the river. I quite mean that. Everything is based on the river. When we encourage people to invest in solar power for themselves and for corporations and businesses to do this the same, because it takes us away from coal-fired plants, because it takes us away from plants like Indian Point, the Dance Camera plant up on the west side of the river that they want to restart. That we can do this with renewables, and the renewables are actually a better option. And when I say this, that our only client is a river. Look at this as a microcosm for the world. My concern is, you like to talk on the global level, and I would love to talk on the global level. And I'm being very honest with you. I work for Riverkeeper. I have one focus. What helps the world, as you can see, helps Riverkeeper. I think that we should all be looking at ways not only to put solar panels and windmills up everywhere, but to find ways to conserve, find ways to use less, find ways to make more efficient use of energy so we don't need all these things. We don't need these things that are going to damage the earth. I mean, the technology is there. It's a big ship to turn, to get energy companies that have been doing things the same way for generations, and to tell them to do it another way is a really tough thing to do. They don't want to be told their business. New York, to give Governor Cuomo some credit, he's been pushing for renewable energy, and I happen to agree with him on that. I think that's what we need to do. I think it's the best thing for us, for this region, and for, like I said, our client, the river.
I think that's a very, very sweet and noble answer. And I think the sturgeon very much appreciate it, despite the fact that a new bridge is going up and that might not be the best thing for them. It might be very difficult for them. What else can you ask people to do besides cutting back their energy use and maybe... You know, I mean, a lot of people still pour their car oil down the drain. I mean, stupid things like that. I mean, I still see garbage strewn on the side of the road. All of that goes into the river. All of that slides eventually. You know, we are having these amazing storms, and all of that refuse goes right into the river, and that can't be good for it. That can't be good for the sturgeon or the Manhattan fish. You know, maybe that's what's killing them, you know, our McDonald's cups.
In addition to trying to be more carbon neutral, which is what I would like to see us do as a society, as a community around the river, I mean, learning how to, like, create less waste, to have less impact in all ways. Things like plastic bags, styrofoam cups, things like that. We've been behind bans on those. I would rather not be the organization that has to demand that there be a ban. I would rather be the organization that engages people and says, you know something, maybe you should go for something something that's renewable. Why don't you put this in something that you're going to wash and clean? Why don't you use a paper cup instead of a styrofoam cup? Why don't you use a reuse bag when you go to the grocery store? I wish it was so easy to tell people that this is all you need to do. And this is the reason why we've been working with communities on these bans. I'm not big on banning things. I don't like to ban stuff. I don't want to say, no, this is bad, you can't use it. However, I think that, you know, if we're going to pull together, sometimes it's hard to convince people to do so. And that's the reason why we back these kind of laws. And basically, if I want to tell anyone to do this, if your community does not have a ban on such items, to maybe sort of consider doing this yourself. Maybe as a household, get together and say, we're not going to use plastic bags. Mm-hmm. We're not going to use styrofoam cups. Mm-hmm. We're going to use less plastic. And if we use plastic, we're going to use stuff that's compostable, stuff that we can actually put back into the earth very easily. And I think that's what we could all do, is find ways to make much less waste, have much less impact on the earth.
That's a wonderful idea. Zero waste philosophy. Bring utensils with you.
Sure.
Absolutely. Cliff, I wanted to thank you so much for speaking with Nature Bats Last today. It's really been a pleasure and an honor.
Thank you.
And you're a wonderful, wonderful guest. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Any last words?
No, just thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
That's our show for this week. You can catch the podcast at Podbean and iTunes. Please remember to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last, on the Progressive Radio Network. And please join our Facebook group as well, which is Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. You can post questions you'd like us to address on the show and suggest topics. You can also follow Guy's blog at www.guymcpherson.com for further updates, essays, and speaking tours, and to stay caught up with his long climate essay, which gets longer and longer every week. Next week, August 4th, we will be celebrating a year of Nature Bats Last Radio. Join Guy McPherson, Mike Sliva, and me as we host the one-year anniversary of what is known as the most radical radio show on the air. We want your feedback, too, so please go to Guy's website at guymcpherson.com to access the survey towards the bottom of any new post that he posts there, and we will give you the results. And we're going to have a Breaking Hopium reunion, so it's going to be live, and it's going to be fun. So be there or be square. And until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end, nature bats.
Every year there's been less clean air than there was the year before that. Every year there are fewer species on the planet than the year before that. We're driving 200 species a day to extinction. We're about to see that turn around. The loving planet is about to make a comeback. And that's really, really good news.
She bats last and she's coming out swinging. She bats last and she's just about taking all that she can take. And it's payback time. Motherfuckers, it's payback time. GMO, for uranium ore, for screwing your kids for a few dollars more. Now it's payback time, motherfuckers, it's payback time.
The loving planet is about to make a comeback. The loving planet is about to make a comeback. The loving planet is about to make a comeback. And that's really, really good news.
She bats last and she's coming out swinging. She bats last and she's just about taking all that she can take. And it's payback time. Motherfuckers, it's payback time. I said it's payback time. Motherfuckers, it's payback time.
You betcha.
planet is about to make a comeback. The living planet is about to make a comeback. The living planet is about to make a comeback. And that's really, really good news.